A town with an eternal fire burning beneath it. A city where everyone lives in the same building. A village with 2 million souls, but they are all dead. These are just some of the unusual places some people call home. Today, strange cities on Cautionary Tales with Harper.
Cautionary Tales, stories that are passed down or around. But are they always true? Do we really know their true meaning or intent? This is the podcast where we dive into cautionary tales, superstitions, mysteries, and more to discover the truth behind the tale. This is Cautionary Tales with Harper.
Welcome to the show. Don't forget to press that subscribe button. It's me, Harper Brewski, my dad, Tony Brewski, my co-host. Dad, have you ever lived in a strange city?
Have I ever lived in a strange city? I'm trying to think. I've lived in towns where things were kind of... I was close to one. I'll say that. I was close to one that was a strange city. When I lived up in Michigan, I lived in the Traverse City, Petoskey area, and you have been to Petoskey. You've even stayed the night in the town that I would call a strange city. It was that little area that we stayed at, I forgot what it was called, and I won't say the name of it because I do like visiting it, but I feel it to be very weird vibes, there. It's got a little downtown that's kind of cool. And then, there's like hotels and apartments that are attached to it. It almost feels like kind of Disney-ish. And then there's all these really beautiful little like vacation homes, I guess, but they're crazily expensive. And they're just immaculately kept up, almost like Stepford Wives weirdness going on. And then behind the gates of that part is the part I've never seen. And then the homes get even bigger and more immaculate and amazing. And when I lived up there, had to go do an event that got me behind the gates one time. And the owner of the radio station that I worked for was part of it. And the station had some sort of involvement, and I had to go to like a clubhouse or something behind these gates. And now I've lived in communities that are gated. I've lived in places, you know, nicer and things of that nature. This takes it to a whole new level. Of like, oh, this is how those groups of people live. And it's weird. Other than, I can't put my finger on it, but they like hired people for the event just to stand there and look pretty. I've never been to an event where if your staff is there not to like work it as like, you know, servers or bartenders or whatever, something with a purpose. I've never been to one except for there where there's literally models hired just to stand around. And there was a lot of like creepy older guys that were there that were, you know, part of the community that was part of this small little elite village. It was weird, and it's probably beyond your understanding yet at this age, but it just felt bizarre, like something was off, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it because there was a lot of families going around, and it was a family type event, but I felt totally uncomfortable, totally out of place, not only because my income at the time certainly was nowhere near theirs, and still to this day is not, nor do I imagine ever it will be. But it was just like, you know, the richest of the rich had properties in there, and they were at this thing, and it was just bizarrely strange in terms of feel. So that would be, I guess, the strangest feel that I've ever been in a town that was just off. I've been in kind of weird small towns that are, you know, falling apart and have problems with, you know, drug abuse and things of that nature. And that's sad, but you kind of know what's going on. And that can be explained. Some of these that we're talking about today, some are explainable. Some are just plain strange as to how they got to where they are today.
What is this town that has a fire beneath it?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Centralia, Pennsylvania. This is a town. In 1981, there was 1,000 people living in Centralia. By 2010, less than a dozen. What exactly happened? Well, there's been a coal mine fire burning beneath the town since 1962. Now, when you have mines, you have large areas of the earth below that have essentially tunnels in them. And then it's propped up by chunks of earth that are still there, but it's tunneled out and they get the minerals out. They're getting the coal is what they were doing in this area. Well, eventually a fire accidentally started. It's underground. It just has nothing but fuel, meaning more coal to burn because it just keeps going through underneath the earth and there's no way to really put the thing out. They've tried many times. So it eventually, because those big pieces of ground way deep down that are, you know, carved out, create sinkholes. And there's no way to stop it. So you have sinkholes that are created, toxic smoke gas. There's a highway that led into the town and they're just letting it go to itself and not to be traveled. It's too hot to touch and it literally cracks open like Ghostbusters and smoke coming out, but ghosts aren't flying out of it. Residents apparently couldn't deal with it, and that's understandable. Although it's been on fire for decades, experts believe that the fire may burn underneath Centralia for 250 more years. So there's no putting this thing out. So for some bizarre reason, it sounds like a place where you'd like to live. You can't. In 1992, the state of Pennsylvania seized all property in the town and condemned it. They allowed the then current residents who were there to stay if they wanted to. But once they're gone, it is the end of Centralia. There's no moving back there. It's not a safe place to inhabit. But I believe there are a few people who still do technically live there who have never left since all of this happened. But there's not many.
And that's just a straight up strange city.
I can't imagine what it would be like. We did a dark side of Wikipedia on Centralia not that long ago and really went into all of the details of how this whole thing went down. And if I remember correctly, a lot of this could have been prevented. There were a lot of cost saving measures that some of the decision makers in the 60s when this fire started put into effect, thinking, oh, well, we'll solve it this way. We know we can put the fire out that way, but that's a bit more expensive than we want. So let's do it this super cheap way over here and see if that works. And basically they wasted that whole time window of where they could have put that fire out realistically and tried to do it the cheap method. And then when it got to the point where, well, okay, let's try the more expensive method. It was so far out of control, it couldn't be done anymore. So it's kind of a lesson sometimes in, you know, prioritizing when it's important to spend money in something and when it's not. And I'm in no way someone who's like, go spend all the money you can on something. No, I'm frugal. I make good choices with money. But sometimes there's just situations where it's like, you got to put money at this right now, whether you want to or not, if you have it, because if you don't, there's no turning back from it. Or if your plan A does not work, there's no plan B. And that is really kind of where that plan or how that town became what it is today through things like that. If you want to hear more about that and the whole story of Centralia, look it up on the Dark Side of Wikipedia, one of our other podcasts. Very interesting town.
It's a lot like the Titanic and how it could have been prevented.
There were a lot of things, yeah, where, you know, had humans made some different choices, there would have likely been a different outcome. And sometimes it's very evident and sometimes it's not. Like the Titanic we talked about the other week, one person forgetting to give someone a key and then others not feeling the need to break that locker open or find another binoculars. It's just these small little things that seem very, very, you know, trivial at the moment, but not major decisions. How major of a decision they can end up being. It's interesting to look into that. Here's another town. It's not on fire. People still live in it, but it looks more like it's a giant, like, Hilton that people are living in, but it's actually a city.
Can I see this?
Yeah, I'll put it up on the screen over here. This is the building itself. And for good reason, it's a small town 58 miles northeast of Anchorage, where everyone lives together in one building. It's a 14-story tower. It's home to 214 people in Whittier, Alaska. It was originally an army barracks, but the tower grew to include a police station, a post office, store, church, video rental shop. I wonder if that's still there. Playground, bed and breakfast, and health center. It's a cozy nook if there ever was one. So that would be a really interesting place. I don't know. I mean, small towns are interesting to visit as they are because they're small towns. Everybody knows each other. And for the most part, unless you're like a family member of someone of those small towns, if you're suddenly hanging around the small town and you don't live there, people notice, and it can be kind of uncomfortable until everybody understands what your presence is there. I can only imagine how amplified that would be in a building like that, where you're in this structure and there's really no place for you to go outside of that structure. And you're just kind of like, hi, I'm just hanging out. You probably wouldn't just hang out, but if you're new there, that would be interesting to try and fit in, I guess. I guess that's one of my fears. I'm not good at that. I'm not good at going and adapting and like, let me fit in with you.
No, I'm not good at that either.
I think it'd be a nightmare to go live in that place. Here's one where there's a population of one person. Monowi, Nebraska. Literally one person who lives there. Her name is Elise Eiler. She used to live in Monowi with her husband, Roy, but he passed away in 2004. Elise is the mayor, the town bartender, and the sole librarian. She pays taxes to herself. As of 2011, Elise was in octogenarian, meaning the town might soon be abandoned. So the town itself looks like it's not going to be around much longer, if it even still is, because that was 10 years ago. I don't know what the current status is of this town or how you could even consider it a town with one person. I'm guessing at one point there must have been more people in that town.
Yeah, with everything like built and the way it is. Whoa, is there like a grocery store there?
Says once a town of 150 people in the 30s, now it's still it is the one person. Elise is the one who is running the town. So no, I mean there's not much. I mean, if you look at this picture, this looks like it was a restaurant or a tavern or something at one time, and now the building is tilting to the left because it's starting to fall apart. But there's places like that all across America, and they're really fascinating to me. There's towns where there's zero people in them that really, you know, it's interesting. You'll see some of the structures and what people had once put up, and you look through the windows and maybe see some peeling wallpaper from a wall, and you just kind of wonder what happened there. What was life like in this town? What was Christmas like in this town in 1945 or whatever years the town was active? And it makes you wonder when you just see those remnants that are still there.
It's like if you had it's like a zombie apocalypse hit, but you killed all the zombies, but there was only one person left.
Yeah, and you're just there with the stuff. Would a zombie apocalypse be better with zombies, or would you prefer the zombie apocalypse to be zombie free?
Zombie free.
Really? Zombie free? Even what if you have options of just a few zombies? You encounter them maybe a couple times a year, not in like any sort of huge horde that you can't take on like Walking Dead style, but just you happen to come across one across your path or something like that, and you can take it out. Mid-range, yeah, you could find a few more, or high is like Walking Dead world. And then there's just no zombies whatsoever. And no, it's just you. There's no other people to be found.
That's actually kind of sounds kind of nice.
Just you?
Just you. I could have all the LOL dolls I want.
immediately go to getting whatever toy you want. I think I would almost be enjoying the zombie world if it was super light zombies and you could easily take them out, because it gives you a little bit of excitement of something else moving around other than yourself. You know, you can explore all you want by yourself, but if everything else is dead, although we didn't really talk if there was animals in this fictitious world.
Exactly.
If you got animals, that's different. Then I'd want no zombies. But if there's no animals, nothing, you're just the only living creature left. Maybe there's bugs, but that's about it. There's no dogs, there's no cats, there's no cows, there's no horses, there's nothing. It's just you and bugs. And then the world in decay. That would be the option. Or you can get a couple zombies where every once in a while you come across one, you can take the zombie out, and then continue on your merry way of finding your LOL dolls.
Just me being alone would be fine.
You're just good with no zombies. Okay. I would vote for a little bit of excitement, but that's just me. Another town here. This is interesting. 2 million people have been laid to rest in Colma, California. Over the 2 square miles, 17 cemeteries, San Mateo County necropolis has been dubbed the City of Souls because it hosts an estimated 2 million dead people, only 1,200 live ones. There's more dead, far more dead in this area than there are living people. Back in the days of William Randolph Hearst and Wyatt Earp, who are actually buried there, they transported bodies from San Francisco to Colma to make room. So the big cities used to almost use it like as their body dump, if you will, where it's like, we have no room over here in the city. Go take them to that town over there and bury them. And eventually there were so many more people that were buried there than actually inhabited the town. You have far more people just spread out there than anything else.
Well, hang on. What is that that's on the screen? That, like, giant mountain colorful thing.
Well, that's our next one that we're going to talk about. But what are your thoughts on having a just giant, giant cemeteries in a very small town?
Sounds like a giant ghost town that could have a lot of ghost tours.
I love cemeteries.
So do I.
So I don't know that it would be that bad of a place to live. You'd have so many interesting places to walk around and you could read about the dead people. To me, it sounds really great.
Yeah, like you can learn about the history and go walk around like small little ghost town areas.
Yeah.
And it would be a great place just like hang out, say hi to all dead people and have some ghost hauntings. That actually sounds like amazing.
Be interesting. What you're seeing on the screen here that you're asking about is called Slab City, California. In the words of Vice, this bizarre, lawless land in the California desert is inhabited by drug addicts, eccentrics, army vets, hippies, and just plain weirdos. Slab City is referred to its residents as the last free place in America. Remember that scene of Into the Wild when Christopher McCandless meets Tracy Tatro? I don't, because I never saw it. That was Slab City. It's a place where hobos can live in peace, off the grid, free to smoke crack and be hippies. There's 150 people who permanently live there, but squatters and RV owners sometimes visit to pass the time. Decommissioned and uncontrolled, Slab City is a bastion of this free-spirited anti-socialite. So it's kind of like this giant concrete mass of no rules, essentially. And I don't know. I think it would be rather interesting. I don't know much about Slab City, but from what I just learned, it seems like a place I don't think I'd want to spend much time at. You?
I want to see the picture on the inside of the city, because all I can see is the outside.
Slab City?
Slab City, people.
Let's see what's going on in Slab City, if there's any more images. So it's a lot of just kind of makeshift stuff. It goes beyond the slab. So the slab is kind of like the entrance. And then it's a lot of, it's like a tent city almost with, you know, whatever they could build around to use as construction materials. Very artsy-like and creative, it looks. But looking at some of the art, I don't think there's any way you could have come up with some of these art designs without being on a lot of drugs. I think that's the only way you could develop some of these ideas. So interesting town there, Slab City.
Can we get a close up of the set of the slab part?
No, we can't. That's the best we got. So go back, sit in your chair, talking to your microphone.
Okay.
Scottsboro, Alabama, the lost luggage capital of the world. You know what that means?
A lot of luggage is there.
Yeah, when an airline loses a bag or something and it never gets returned to the owner, it ends up here. If they can't find the owner, it ends up here. Nearly 7,000 units of unclaimed baggage from around the world make its way to Scottsboro, Alabama, in the Appalachian Mountains every single day. I imagine that number has gone down quite a bit since COVID. The Unclaimed Baggage Center receives nearly 1 million unclaimed bags and suitcases each year. The UBC buys lost luggage only after the airline puts it through intensive tracking, meaning no one showed up to claim their items. Eventually, the UBC sells the found belongings. Doyle Owens started the UBC in Alabama as a part-time business in 1970. Since then, the company has grown to take over almost an entire city block, 40,000 square feet, in downtown Scottsboro. Complex has a museum in it, which features unusual found items. More than half of what the UBC finds is clothing, though expensive electronics and other goods are included. Once found a $20,000 painting, which a store later sold for $60. In another case, the guidance system for an F-16 fighter jet valued at $250,000 and a camera specifically designed for NASA's space shuttle were both returned to the government, but somehow ended up in somebody's piece of luggage.
Well, that actually kind of sounds kind of nice. Like, I would be that person like, ooh, I'm so curious on what's in there.
It would be like the eternal, it's like LOL dolls for grownups. Because it's this suitcase, it could have clothing that fits you. It may have parts to an F-16 fighter jet in it. You don't know until you open it.
Yeah, it's like, and some of those suitcases might even belong to kids that have LOL dolls. Yeah,
yes, that could be the what happens too. It's just amazing to me, though, what people will put in a suitcase. I am such a stickler on suitcases and airlines losing suitcases, because the one time I sit there and go, they're not going to lose it, they lose it. It's happened to me more than once. So what I only do carry on when it comes to flying. And I have gotten so creative in how I can pack things. You'd be amazed how much I can pack into a carry-on bag. I can pack for more than a week of clothes, including a suit and everything. And I've done it in straight carry-on luggage. And but what amazes me is what some people will check, meaning let the airline get their hands on and hopefully make it from point A to point B. Things like a $20,000 painting, part of an F-16 jet, a camera designed for NASA's space shuttle. Why on earth you would just put that into your suitcase?
Out of all places,
it's one thing if you're shipping it.
Yeah, like, you know it's going to get to the right place.
Yeah. You got a tracking on it. You're shipping it specifically through a shipping company. That's different. But your odds of bags going missing on an airplane, I don't know, 1 in 10 or less? I don't know. It may be greater than that.
It's actually pretty much like 10% that you're probably going to
lose it.
Exactly.
So to put that much risk on an item like that, if I do ever check anything, I am only putting things in that suitcase that I can easily and quickly replace and do not cost me that much.
Yeah, like a $10 shirt.
Yeah, something like that. Something that will not be a giant loss. But I don't know. Some people just don't have a whole lot of judgment. This is a town I used to pass sometimes when I lived in Michigan, Hell, Michigan. A town that really embraces the name, Hell, Michigan. It's a small town located in the southeastern part of the state, close to Ann Arbor, originally a milling town and later town full of bootleggers. The town was with the name Hell really embraced it. As the story goes, Hell got its name after one of the city's founders was asked what he wanted to name it in the 1840s. He responded, "You can name it for hell, for all I care." Well, it stuck. The town has profited from the name. They've embraced hell and Satan. You can even get married in a devil church. You can buy a plot in hell. The website says, buy a piece of hell. Get a gravedigger Sunday at the creamery of at Screams, and even have a burger at the Hellhole Diner, whose pastries are apparently to die for, they say. Hell also has a fake university called Damnation University. Damn you, for short. So they try and do their best to live up the town.
If you're going to call a town hell, just avoid it. Mm-hmm. And like, don't embrace it. Like, just like stick with the name, but don't embrace it.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting of what goes on there in hell, Michigan. Here's one. This different areas of the country have different dialects. You know what a dialect is?
No.
A dialect is like accents, if you will. There's Southern accents, there's Northern accents, there's New York, there's New Jersey, there's Eastern, there's Western, there's all different types of dialects. It's the way that you pronounce words and such that, you know, do a Southern accent.
Hi, y'all.
Okay, now do one if it was my mom from up north.
It's hard to do.
Oh, yeah. You know, we're up here in Wisconsin, and it's a little bit cold. You know, it's almost Minnesotan, almost Canadian. Anyway, this town, Tangier, Virginia, is located on Tangier Island in the Chesapeake Bay. Not only is it one of the oldest cities in America, but it also has one of the most unique sounding cities in the town. The island itself, although it's not far from like the mainland, the people on this island have a very unique accent in itself, just from the island. So it's not super big, but they have their own dialect, which is really kind of interesting. Linguistics say it's unlike any other place in the U.S. just because it's a dialect. The locals, it's a forgotten mix of an American accent, like old American, with a mix of British twang. Some suspect the founding fathers and early settlers of America probably spoke very similarly to the way the residents of this town speak. And it's lived on somehow, having water as a barrier between the rest of the land and the rest of Virginia has kind of kept that alive. And I think that's really kind of interesting to see that.
Can we hear it? Like, is there any way?
I do not have a way for us to hear.
But can you try to pronounce it the way that you think it actually sounds?
I have no idea how it actually sounds. I really do not know. So no, my answer.
Wait, go back up.
This?
Is that a giant chair?
Yes, Casey, Illinois. It's the town of large objects. Casey, Illinois has been around since 1834 and about 2.16 square miles in size. As of 2013, the population is 2,752 people. It's a relatively small town, but what makes it special is they're known for housing big things or objects that are far out of proportion to their intended size. There's a pencil that stands 32 feet 6 inches there and a rocking chair that's 56 feet tall. Casey has plenty of big things to visit, but most impressively, there are at least 8 items that have been officially certified by the Guinness Book of World Records as being the largest in the world.
Can we see some of these things?
From Casey, Illinois. I'm going to try and pull up some pictures and see exactly what we have for the large objects. I bet there's a lot of the chair, giant mailbox that you can go into, giant car key, giant pencil. It would really be an interesting town to swing through if you're ever there.
I would love that. Hey, giant antlers.
Look at that. Giant top, like a spinning top. Giant mouse trap. That's fun. The town found something to embrace, and that's what they do, and that's what they're known for, and that's what makes people come and see it.
Hang on. Go down. A giant hammer.
That's actually like a court hammer, like a not an anvil. But I'm trying to think what it's called in court, but that's what they have. So interesting place. I would love to go check that one out. So there you go. Interesting places to live that we talked about on today's program.
That wraps up today's episode. Be sure to press the subscribe button wherever you download podcasts and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And remember, if you don't ask the right questions, you may end up being part of a cautionary tale. For Cautionary Tales with Harper, I'm Harper Brewski.